Hello, and welcome to episode number 56 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exo Academian. In the two previous episodes of the podcast, we covered the key elements of the case of Terry Lovelace, a man who's had a lifetime of experiences with apparently non-human, alien intelligences. Lovelace's case is punctuated by events known as abductions, which involve human beings being visited by these alien others and then transported by way of their technology up into craft, either situated above a particular location or apparently orbiting the Earth. In one instance, Lovelace recounts being transported to a massive mothership, so large that it needed to be parked on the far side of the moon in order to not be visible to the naked eye of those on Earth. As it turns out, a case such as Lovelace's is not terribly unique. In fact, beyond certain fairly superficial differences, this case bears remarkable similarity to a host of other cases documented within the annals of the UFO phenomenon literature. In fact, it is not a stretch to say that this particular kind of alien interaction is one of the most commonly reported. And of course, that's precisely why I picked Lovelace's case to highlight, because it is so representative of a larger phenomenon that speaks to a group of alien others interacting with human beings all across the planet and over the course of multiple generations. So now that we've taken the time to highlight some of the specifics of Lovelace's case and how it played out over the course of his lifetime, in this episode, I'd like to dive into the key elements of these particular kinds of cases that, again, are well attested throughout the UFO phenomenon literature. What the data tells us is that, barring some massive disinformation campaign involving thousands of people all across the world, co-conspiring to enact some bizarre and unwieldy psyop, these events really are happening in one way or another. This particular kind of human-alien interaction is going en masse as we speak. This answers the what's happening or what is it aspect of the UFO phenomenon, or at least in relation to one aspect of it, because again, as I keep trying to drive home, from my perspective, what we conveniently call the UFO phenomenon is likely an amalgam of numerous phenomena arising from different intelligences with likely different origin stories, not to mention different agendas. But in relation to this one key element of the larger phenomenon, knowing what's happening only serves to beg certain key questions, such as, who's involved? Why are they doing it? And how are they doing it? We might also ask, how is it that this is happening seemingly under the very noses of the world's populace? Said differently, why the societal ignorance and/or disinterest? And to what degree are the governments of the world aware of this phenomenon, and to what degree might they actually be involved? These are the very thorny but essential questions we'll seek to find some clarity on in this, the 56th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As I mentioned in the introduction, in the two episodes previous to this, we discussed the Terry Lovelace case in some detail. And while we'll only be touching on that case in passing today, because we're going to focus more on the key trends that are found within these cases, you may want to go back and listen to those two podcast episodes first, episodes 54 and 55, so that you'll fully understand what's going on in what we discussed today. Now, Terry's case is one of thousands just like it, or so closely aligned with numerous other encounters, so as to suggest that this kind of encounter is descriptive of a specific kind of event or series of events orchestrated by the same definitive type of entities. Now, let's first discuss what's involved with these kinds of cases. There are numerous elements we want to touch on here. Number one, the people being interacted with by these non-human beings often begin to experience this kind of event in childhood. Now, it's worth noting that sometimes it's only later in life, in adulthood, that certain associative events trigger memories that help these individuals realize they had had encounters with these beings even as young children. So that's the first element, that it begins in childhood. Very commonly, that's the case. In fact, you could almost argue that for these kinds of entities and these kinds of cases, if you're already an adult and you do not have any memory of these kinds of cases, unless they've been repressed, the chances are if you've not been interacted with yet, one could argue that you won't, because it seems like a very common trend that those that do have these experiences have them from childhood on. Sometimes it lasts into early adulthood and then cuts off, and then sometimes it happens throughout the entire lifetime, and sometimes it happens with long spans in between, a decade or more, or 2 decades even, when nothing seemingly happens. Of course, because these others can control perception and consciousness, we can't be sure of that last metric. It may be that they are interacting with us even in those in-between times, but we're just not aware of it. I should also bring to your attention that there is one suggestion out there that posits that perhaps everyone is being interacted with by these beings, that everyone, or at least almost everyone, is being abducted, or at least vast segments of the population are. And it's just that a certain segment, a certain subsection of the population has the capacity to remember these events. Now, as I also mentioned in the introduction, the next element is that these people are taken by these others and then transported on board what seemed to be some kind of craft. Now, it should be pointed out here that some will argue this is an illusion, that actually these people are only being interacted with in their consciousness, so to speak. In other words, they perceive being taken to another craft, but perhaps they never left their bedrooms. That's what some people would posit. But of course, this begs the question, how do we explain artifacts in manifest reality that are tied to these events? Here we're talking about elements like radar returns, soil indentations, shrubbery burns, markings on the grass. Of course, and in terms of the individuals themselves, they very often have marks left on their bodies, or radiation burns, etc. So that seems to suggest that this is happening at a level of reality beyond just the people's perception alone. Now, in terms of the kinds of craft they are transported to, this really covers the gamut. You get everything from your traditional flying saucer to triangles to massive orbital craft that look like massive rectangles. And people have actually put together illustrative charts showing all the different variations on the different kinds of craft described. And it really does cover the gamut. It is quite amazing. So much so that one actually wonders if perhaps shape-shifting is part and parcel with these craft. And some people have actually seen that happening. Perhaps they have no fixed shape. It's worth considering that as well. All right, let's move on to the next very common element attributed to these kinds of encounters. The next one on our list is the control of space-time. Now here we think back to the case of Richard Hastings and his book Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed, which he co-authored with Bob Jacobs. And by the way, that case was covered in episode number 30. And in that case, you may recall that Hastings was returned to his family home after an abduction and found his family seated around the dinner table, frozen in place. We're talking about absolute, complete, suspended animation. You can picture a fork held halfway towards someone's mouth, their mouth agape, and they're just frozen in place like that. It's accounts like these that suggest that their level of control over what we consider space-time is enormous and extensive. Only once Richard Hastings sat down at the table again did his family members reanimate. And then it's not hard to imagine that from their perspective, there was no gap. They had been eating at the table all along, and Richard never left the table. Of course, for the others, they were able to freeze the family, remove Richard, conduct whatever experiments they did or whatever kind of training they did for him, which he only partially recalls. And then when he was returned to his family, everything resumed as if nothing had happened. And again, this is a key element of these encounters, and it helps explain why so much of this can be going on, why this kind of manipulation of the human populace can be so extensive, so wide-reaching, and yet most people are completely oblivious. Because when you control space-time, or at least the perception of it, because again, it's relative, then you can conduct almost any kind of activity you want with the majority of the populace being oblivious. And here we're reminded of the element we discussed last time, where there's often this sense of silence for abductees. Just before an abduction is about to happen or a sighting, they'll notice this uncanny lack of sound. the usual sounds that they would hear in the forest, for instance, in the case from last week where Terry Lovelace was abducted along with his friend Toby, or even it could be a bustling city street that suddenly seems uncannily quiet. It's because the relative space-time has been frozen or slowed down to such a degree that that's what it ends up sounding like, that the experiencer and the entities themselves are in one relative space-time while the rest of the populace is in a different one. Again, when you have this kind of control, you can conduct massive operations and it's largely undetected. And by the way, as an aside, this is partly why I find the notion that we could defend ourselves against these others so ludicrous, because regardless of how many weapons you have and how fast they are and how weaponized they are, and we already know we are far behind them in that regard, when they can control your perception of space-time, then those weapons and those defenses are effectively rendered useless. Okay, let's move on to the next element, which is people having various medical procedures conducted upon them. This seems to contain both elements of exploration, in other words, these others trying to understand our anatomy. In fact, Terry Lovelace mentions this, that he gets the sense that this is partly what they're doing when he finds himself under their scalpel, so to speak. But it's also for the sake of harvesting of genetic material. Again, that is front and center with this phenomenon, particularly in these kinds of cases. Now, the medical procedures can often be painful, leaving not necessarily physical scars. In fact, they are very adept at not leaving any scars. And in fact, in the two implants that Terry Lovelace later finds, there is no evidence of how they were ever put in. And doctors are even perplexed by this because they say that any kind of surgery that would involve placing something under the skin would leave some form of scar tissue, even if it was microscopic, and yet they could find none. But while there are no superficial scars on the skin, there are no doubt subconscious mental scars, producing, for instance, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as we saw in Terry's case. And if you remember from last week, the large insectoid kind of mantid creature that was operating on him seemed perplexed, even annoyed, that Terry was screaming while this medical procedure was being undertaken. And based on the dialogue, at least according to how Terry remembers it, this being didn't understand how if Terry knew that they never actually hurt him and that he's always returned basically unharmed, they didn't understand why he continued to scream during these kinds of incidences. But of course, it's because partly he was experiencing physical pain in real time. Now, what's interesting is that this creature tapped the side of his head and then he went black, which tells us again they could have done that all along, which begs the question, why don't they? Is this just a translation issue that they just don't understand our psychology enough to incorporate this basic bedside manner? Or is there something else going on? Is some kind of trauma being deliberately induced? That's worth considering as well, because the fact that they don't take more care when they clearly have the capacity to do so makes one wonder. And in fact, in all these different kinds of scenarios that we describe, I want you to think about that. Is there possibly some sort of subversive psychological aim with any particular element of these cases? That's especially worth considering when the particular element seems unnecessary, at least on a physical level. And I will bring to your attention that abductees slash contactees like Whitley Strieber have suggested that this level of trauma can be conducive to a kind of psychological and spiritual opening, which allows for profound spiritual transformation. I understand some people will find that controversial, and it seems to make an excuse for this kind of behavior by these others. But this is an experiencer himself describing this and noticing the end result in himself. So it's worth considering. Now, of course, another key element of these medical procedures involves the harvesting of genetic material. And these kinds of encounters often involve sexual elements, some as simple and cold as a machine extracting sperm or eggs, or human beings being introduced to what appear to be examples of that individual's ideal physical sexual partner in order to facilitate a sexual encounter and then direct impregnation. Both of these kinds of scenarios are rampant in these abductions. Both a kind of cold, machine-like extraction, as well as the inducement of actual sexual encounters with beings that are not exactly what they appear to be. Sometimes these human beings even see these supposed sexual partners having their facial features shifting in real time, giving hints again that they are not exactly what they appear to be, and that a screen memory of some sort is being used to bring about the desired outcome. And speaking of that, in Terry's second book, which is titled Devil's Den, The Reckoning, which includes a series of letters that other people have sent him following reading his book, one man recounts an experience where first he was sprayed with some kind of substance that basically caused physical arousal in him, and then he was introduced to a being that seemed like his ideal human physical partner. Again, in situations like this, it's hard to argue for some sort of subversive psychological ploy. It seems like the end goal is to obtain sperm, and in these cases with an actual partner is being used, though perhaps in disguise, for the sake of impregnation directly. Again, this element is very common in the literature, and likewise, follow-up encounters with what appeared to be the actual human-alien hybrid offspring of these humans are often introduced to them, sometimes with the hopes that some sort of bonding will occur between the offspring and the human being, which again in itself is somewhat strange because apparently it seems like often they're given a few minutes as if these aliens are trying to check off the list, okay, bonding has happened, when we know when it comes to the raising of healthy human beings, you need to have an ongoing relationship with the parents, especially the mother, in order to promote a healthy overall psychology and the emergence of a healthy sense of self. So these one-and-done introductions seem somewhat strange in that sense. Again, this could be, again, a translation error, that they just don't understand the psychology. Perhaps they do not raise their young this way. It's hard to know, but again, a very strange element, but no doubt, very commonly, these human beings who've had their genetic material harvested by these others later encounter their very own offspring, which clearly look to be only part human, but also part alien. But from the part that is human, they do recognize their own biological traits. In other words, they do believe that these are actually their offspring, and they often experience a kind of love between the entity and themselves. But again, one really cannot overstate this aspect of the phenomenon. The harvesting of genetic material resulting in hybrid offspring seems to be front and center much of the time. Another key element that often arises in these kinds of experiences is a kind of schooling, especially when the human beings are children. And indeed, Terry Lovelace mentions this as well. Often this kind of training or schooling involves training in telepathic communication as well as telekinetic manipulation of the environment. And interestingly, if you remember from last week, the hybrid being who is kind of a guide for Terry throughout his life informs him that while he tends to feel psychologically exposed, she says to him that he can learn to guard his thoughts even though they are using telepathic communication. So that's interesting as well, because in addition to hybrid offspring being produced by a combination of these human donors and alien others, there also seems to be a training of these actual human beings so they develop their psi capacities. One wonders, why is this the case? Is this partly to bring about a scenario where communication happens more easily between the two species? Because presumably you could argue that if Terry learns how to use telepathy and telekinetic powers, that he could perhaps pass that on to his lineage even on Earth. And when you add to that the next element we're going to discuss, which is that these are multi-generational encounters, that makes even more sense. That perhaps in addition to a tweaking of the genome of those specific genetic lineages, there is also a kind of training that happens to develop certain psi capacities. Again, perhaps for the sake of some sort of future communication or future intermingling of the species, when a more pronounced and direct introduction actually takes place. All right, moving on to the next element that is common in these kinds of scenarios. These human beings often see aliens, of course, on board these craft, and often more than one kind of alien. Your typical gray alien is often seen, sometimes the short and the tall grays, or one or the other, but also other kinds of aliens, such as the mantids, for instance, or other kind of insectoid types, or reptilians, or even more humanoid but not purely human figures like Nordics, for instance. And of course, as we've already discussed, beings that look to be hybrids, part human and part alien, are often encountered as well. Now, as we learned in Terry's case last week, sometimes what's seen is aquarium-like areas, where entities seem to be being grown in a kind of artificial environment. Again, perhaps this is an insight into the difference between how human bonding happens and how relationship happens between offspring and the mother, even in the womb, and the way that these other entities are formed in artificial environments as embryos. Now, we've already touched on this in part, but of course, this raises the question, where are these hybrid children going? Are they being introduced to the Earth? Well, some, yes. It appears that, especially the ones that could pass for us, physically I mean, they are repopulated on the Earth at times. But that is far from the full picture. Many experiencers learn that these hybrids are being repopulated elsewhere, that the galaxy and the larger cosmos is teeming with life, and that there are various humanoid or hybridoid civilizations across the cosmos. Apparently, some of these beings live on ships most of their lives, while others are repopulated to planets in our and other galaxies. But the bottom line is here, we should not assume that all of this hybridization that is happening is purely for the introduction of these beings onto the Earth, especially when people think about some sort of takeover scenario. That just does not seem to be realistic, and it's not what is described to experiencers generally. The next element we want to discuss, which is related to the beings that are encountered while on board the craft, is what appears to be a kind of social or professional hierarchy of these beings. Now, the mantids, the 7-foot-tall insectoid beings that bear a remarkable resemblance to praying mantis insects from the Earth, seem to be very often at the top of the chain, so to speak. Then come the tall greys, which are often seen in a kind of overseer role. And then you have the small greys, which are often depicted or understood to be a kind of automaton, perhaps semi-organic AI. Now note, I see some people trying to make hardline distinctions here. All I can say is that would be very difficult to do. In other words, it's very difficult to know for sure whether or not these are robots or something more biological. They may be an amalgam of the two, perhaps using a kind of technology we just don't understand yet. But trying to distinguish whether they are robots or androids or something more biological by using the naked eye is kind of like us today trying to distinguish between a photo that has been photoshopped versus one that has not been. One can no longer trust the naked eye because the technology is so good now. Either way, these small grays are often described as automatons or servants of the taller beings, whether they be the taller greys or the mantid beings. Terry himself describes these small greys as quote-unquote worker bees. Another element that is sometimes found in these cases, and indeed it was part of the Terry Lovelace case, and we've already touched on it in passing, is that implants are found inside humans' bodies later on. Apparently they can track us with these devices. And we should also note that some contactees slash abductees have been told that their health is monitored by these devices as well. In other words, they are not only for potentially nefarious purposes. Now again, one wonders here, couldn't they use more microscopic implants to the point where they would be almost undetectable? When you think about how small, how microscopic our tech is now, if they are supposedly further along than us, why couldn't they use something so tiny that it's largely imperceptible, certainly hardly visually perceptible? Again, one wonders, is there more than meets the eye going on there? Is there something beyond face value? That said, one of the letters that was written to Terry in his second book depicted a situation where a child was visited and to some degree haunted because he didn't understand it by these greys who would show up in his room when he was a child. And as is often the case, it was also the case for Terry, this particular child couldn't get his parents to believe him. They thought he was making the entire thing up. One day, he was sneezing, and out came some sort of object from deeply embedded in his brain. He actually took it out and showed his mother, hoping that she would finally believe him, because clearly this was something non-organic that had been implanted inside his brain. She didn't believe him. She just threw it away, didn't want to talk about it. But interestingly, the visits stopped after that. And so this particular person who is writing Terry as an adult now, believe that that's how they tracked him, and perhaps once they no longer had that tracking device, perhaps they could no longer find him. Again, that seems hard to believe based on their technology, but perhaps they decided it wasn't worth tracking him at that point, or following him, or interacting with him anymore because of what happened with the implant. The next element we will discuss is a notion of a coming apocalypse, an imminent collapse of some kind, perhaps environmental, or perhaps a disaster that happens via some object from space or something like that. This is often part of the narrative as well for experiencers, contactees, slash abductees. And of course, this is interesting because it aligns with information we discussed during the three-part series on the future human hypothesis, which was episodes 46, 47, and 48. Now, if you remember, in those episodes, we talked about the notion that some people within the intelligence community, reported by people such as Frank Milburn and Ross Coulthart, were claiming that some of the Greys were actually future humans, different factions of future humans who were coming back in time in order to change our timeline as it pertains to some coming apocalypse. Now, whether or not that's the case, we don't know. There's not definitive evidence either way, of course. But it is interesting how this overlaps with messages that are given to experiencers from the Greys that don't claim to be time-traveling humans. Why is it that there is such a common ground here between different experiencer stories where the narratives often include some element of coming apocalypse? Now, to be clear, this happens both in cases where people have positive and negative experiences with these others. In other words, some people, for instance, Susie Hansen, report having a positive, ongoing, cooperative relationship with these others that, again, began in childhood. But even though she has a positive experience with these others, she feels that part of her role is to become an ambassador, to be able to help when some sort of apocalypse does arise in our future. And she seems to believe this will happen in her lifetime. And with her being in her 60s now, I believe, that's not that far in the future, if indeed that is true. Now, the next element we want to discuss is the military knowledge, collusion, and potential involvement with these others. Remember, in Terry's case, we had the involvement of humans in tan flight suits with orange insignias of rank. Now, Terry wonders aloud if those are U.S. military personnel of one kind or another, and this, of course, is connected to his sense that during his interrogation and his hypnotic regression conducted by the Office of Special Investigations, he got the sense that they knew more than they should, that the abduction phenomenon was not a new matter to them. So putting two and two together, he wonders if actually there is a collusion between the two groups and that U.S. military personnel are actually serving on board some of these spacecraft being run by the aliens. Now, I would make a couple points here. Again, we shouldn't assume that just because we see humans or humanoid figures on board these craft, that these are necessarily earthly humans, earthlings, if you will. Again, a common theme throughout these narratives is that there are humans all over the cosmos, humanoid figures, perhaps as part of some cosmic seeding program that happened in the distant past. We've also discussed the possibility of convergent evolution and how that might have brought about the arising of humanoid or human-like figures on different planets even. So we shouldn't assume that if we come across humans on board these craft, that they are humans from Earth that have been transplanted into these craft, nor should we assume that if they look like military personnel, that they are actually from the U.S. military, for instance, or some other earthly nation state. In fact, from my point of view, if they are connected to the Earth, I believe it's more likely these humans serve as part of some kind of planted or embedded or breakaway civilization on the Earth, rather than from some official nation state that is known to us. But again, most likely, I think these are humans from elsewhere. Now, we've already partly discussed who's involved, but let's get more specific about that. What we seem to often find is a coordinated association of different alien types, mantids, greys, sometimes hybrids, humanoid humans, etc., that seem to be working together, or at least seem to have some sort of cooperative agreement. Now, are all these aliens coming from some far-flung star system? Have they come here from some other planetary system? Well, I would say that's complicated. Perhaps originally, or perhaps not, for some of them. But experiencers share the sense that some of them have been here longer than we have, and that these others may even be responsible for our origin, or at least for our genetic enhancement along the way. Now think, for instance, of a turkey and how that is actually supposedly a descendant of a creature like a T-Rex. They've gotten smaller over time because of evolutionary responses to changes in the physical environment of the Earth. Now think of this in terms of how we find insects and reptiles on the Earth that often bear a striking similarity to some of these beings, suggesting the possibility of a tie to the Earth, a direct connection to the Earth, at least at some point in its history. So you see how it gets complicated, because even if they originally came from some far-flung star system, or because they've developed technologically so much that they've become a multi-system civilization, they may have come from here originally. So while I've pointed out that the term alien in its most root form just means other, and they certainly are other to us, we should be cautious in assuming that alien means space alien, or that they've come from somewhere else necessarily. Perhaps they have not. Perhaps they've been here longer than we have. Now, speaking of where they come from, we would be remiss to have this conversation without also acknowledging that there seems to be a sense that these others, especially creatures like the mantids, don't usually exist in our sort of 3D plus one kind of reality, that they have a different fundamental relationship to space-time than we do. And that's why often our experiences with them can feel quite disjointed. And because of that, I'm suspicious of the notion that they are trying to create some sort of takeover mechanism so that they can run the world. I don't think that's their intention, and I don't think they will ever want to or perhaps even be capable of living alongside us in the world that we inhabit in our daily lives. Again, this may be the point of the hybrids, to create beings that are something like us and something like them. Not only beings that therefore could live with us alongside us in the kind of reality we exist within, but beings that would be partly them and partly us, so they would create a bridge of understanding, somewhat like Spock on Star Trek, who was part Vulcan, alien, and part human. Something like that may be in the cards. And speaking of that, one final note I would like to leave you with is a question around why the hybrids may be here, why the hybrids may be in the process of being introduced into our civilization. Why would this be the case? And why is it also possible that our genome is being manipulated as we speak? How might that be connected to our collective dance with death, the misalignment that exists between our technological capacity to destroy ourselves and our consciousness capacity to come together in a sense of global communion? And if it is the case that they have decided that perhaps without intervention, either via direct genetic manipulation or a diluting of the aggressive tendencies in our population by introducing hybrids, that the chances that we will end up destroying ourselves and taking along innocent bystanders that exist as part of the symbiotic biosphere that we are a part of is simply too high a likelihood to leave alone. Is that an argument that when you look at the current state of our civilization, you can actually, in good conscience, disagree with? A question worth pondering, I would suggest. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.